This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books Network. I am your host, Steven Sakevich, of the Russian and Eurasia Studies channel. Konstantin Nikolaevich Leontief lived from 1831 until 1891, which coincided with the golden age of Russian literature of the 19th century. Leontief threw himself deeply into the fierce intellectual debates of his time, discussing the nature of topics ranging from ethics, art, Russia's proper place in the world, the historical rise and fall of civilizations, and the nature of religious faith. Although he remains an enigmatic figure to the English-speaking world today, he is a towering figure in his homeland. To discuss this multifaceted intellectual is my guest for this episode, Glenn Cronin, author of the book Disenchanted Wanderer, The Apocalyptic Vision of Konstantin Leontief, published by Cornell University Press. Glenn Cronin is a contributing author to Ideology in Russian Literature and holds a PhD in Russian Studies from the University of London. Glenn Cronin, welcome to the New Books Network.
Well, thank you, Stephen. Glad to be here.
Yep. We usually like to start off with asking the guests to explain their background and how did they get onto this current project?
Yes, well, my background's a little unorthodox. I'm not a professional academic. About 30 years ago, I was looking around for something to do as a PhD thesis, and my tutor at the time, Donald Rayfield, suggested Leontief. So I spent the next 4 years looking at him, and I successfully defended my PhD on him. At that time, there didn't seem to be an awful lot of appetite for a book, and I had other things to do anyway, so I let it lie. And then not long ago, I realized that in the intervening period, there still hadn't been anything written about him very much. I mean, there are some small things. So I thought I'd have a go at turning into a book, and that's the book you've got there.
Now, why do you think there has been so little attention to Konstantin Leontief in scholarship, especially in the English-speaking world?
Yeah, it's not so much there's little attention. It's been very sporadic. You have to go back really to the 1920s and Nikolai Berdyaev to get a really in-depth analysis of his work. I think there's probably a couple of reasons. Relatively little of his stuff has been translated into English, which makes it a little inaccessible apart from dedicated Russian scholars. And there's been a very welcome addition to that, actually, lately. Mr. K. Benoit has brought out a translation of Leontief's main work, Byzantinism and Slavdom, which should help. Of course, he became a non-person in Soviet times as well. And to be frank, his views may be a little difficult for some in the Western liberal intelligentsia as well. So that may have played a role too. But of course, since Perestroika, he's come very much back into focus in Russia, and I hope now in the West as well.
That's very fascinating. Yeah, you mentioned Berdyaev, and I remember reading this book, a phrase that he once said, that one Leontiev is almost worth like 100 professors, something to that effect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, when you want to find out about the Russian psyche, yes, I agree with that absolutely. He's a very condensed course in Russian psychology, I suppose you could say.
Now, before we begin about talking about Leontiev himself, maybe we should kind of explain for our listeners kind of like the intellectual milieu of Russia in the mid-19th century, particularly like the Slavophiles and the Westernizers, which kind of form a lot of the background to Leontiev's thinking.
Yes, absolutely. Well, this is the classic dichotomy in Russian thought since at least the time of Peter the Great and right up to now, because the debates on Russia's position in the world, whether it's a Western country or an East or a mixture or whatever, are really lively under Putin. Of course, Peter the Great tried to drag Russia towards the West. He founded St. Petersburg as a window on the West, as he called it. His efforts were partly successful. I mean, the famous Peter Chadayev in the early 19th century said that this process should accelerate. This brought about a reaction among those Russians who believed that Russian culture should be somehow protected from dilution by Western ideas. The Slavophiles, as they became known under people like Alexei Chomyakov, Ivan Kirievsky and the Aksakov brothers. So you had this tension in Russia between the Westernizing camp and the pro-Slav camp. And it really is the central feature, I think, of Russian thought throughout the 19th century and, as I say, right up to the present day.
Yeah, now you begin the book with Leontiev's relationship with the famous Russian writer Ivan Turgenev, and eventually this led him into an intellectual debate with Nikolai Chernyshevsky, who famously wrote the novel What Is to Be Done, which had a big influence on Russian thought, particularly on Lenin later on, decades later. Can you explain this in further detail?
Well, Leontiev very much admired Turgenev, but I don't think he was a particularly formative influence on him as a writer. I think people like Vissarion Belinsky, the famous Russian literary critic, and also Western writers like Georges Sand, had a much greater influence on Leontiev, who always had a strong aesthetic sensibility. There was a famous incident where his mother took him as a very young child to the monastery of Optina Pustin. And when they were leaving, Leontiev said he found it so beautiful that please don't ever bring me here again, he said, or I might never leave. So he had this strong aesthetic sensibility, and it came into conflict with the prevailing outlook in Russian letters at the time. Epitomized by the magazine Sovremennik and its editor Chernyshevsky and later Dobrolyubov, whose view was that art had first and foremost to a moral duty to highlight the insufficiencies in Russian society. This didn't suit Leontiev's book at all, and he use the example of Turgenev's book On the Eve to demonstrate, as he said, where Turgenev himself was falling down aesthetically by coming under the sway of the moralistic outlook. Turgenev never forgave him, actually, for that. And he was quite cutting about Leontiev's ability later on, partly justified, partly not, I think. But, yeah, that's the background to that, anyway.
Yeah, and then he kind of drops out of university and then serves military service in the Crimean War, I believe in the medical corps.
Yes.
And then afterwards, then he found work in the diplomatic corps, and he sent to the Ottoman Empire. And this kind of had a bit of a impact on him, both personally and also on his intellectual views. Can you probably explain this in further detail?
Yes, he didn't actually drop out of university. He qualified as a doctor. There was an exemption given because of the war that final year students could qualify without taking their final exams if they were prepared to serve in the army, which he did in the Crimea. Yes, and you're quite right. He got a job in the diplomatic corps and was sent to European Turkey. He was based in Constantinople, but he travelled far and wide within the Ottoman Empire in Europe. It had a huge effect on him. It stimulated his aesthetic sensibilities enormously. And the product of this were a number of stories, which he called his Greek stories, which were really about, well, they were called the life of Christians in Turkey at the time. It also gave him the opportunity to try and live out his ideal of an aesthetic life. And that caused problems in the end, because I think it caused huge moral conflicts within him, which eventually led to his religious crisis. It also produced a number of his best works, in my opinion, particularly two novels, A Husband's Confession and Two Chosen Women, which portray this conflicted personality quite well, I think. But I think I could say more when we talk about his religious crisis, if you like.
Yeah, I was just about to ask you about that. In 1871, he has a kind of a conversion experience. And you even begin the book in the introduction with this story. And I was so struck by that. I even took like pictures of the text and sent it to a friend. And it's like, yeah, you got to read this story. And I only did the first page, but then he's like, oh, I read this. So what happened next? And so I had to kind of fill in the details on the next page, but he's like, oh man, that's so awesome. So, but yeah, perhaps yeah. You could explain it in more detail, but yeah, it was a real striking story. So I even had to share it with a friend.
It's a very dramatic incident indeed. And almost everybody who's ever written about Leon Tiev sees it as the great watershed in his life. He thought he was dying. He thought he had cholera. It turned out not to be cholera. Actually, it was malaria. And then he prayed to the Virgin on what he thought was his deathbed to come and cure him. And miraculously, she appeared to do that. And he said if he recovered, he would go to Athos, the great monastic community near Salonika in Greece, and become tonsured as a monk, which he did. But the monks on Athos, I think, quite perceptibly realised that he wasn't really ready for that step. But he spent about 18 months there, and he was a changed man afterwards. I think when he came out, he ceased writing novels, really, by and large, and turned to writing on social and political matters. He also became devoted to a peculiarly severe form of ascetic orthodox faith, which stayed with him to the end of his life.
Yeah, and you kind of briefly on the previous question talked about his aesthetic views and his world point. And this has often led him to be compared to the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. In fact, he's often been called the Russian Nietzsche. So maybe, and you do spend some time explaining like the similarities between the two, even though Leontiev's writings actually predate Nietzsche by several decades.
Yes, they do. Yes, many commentators have picked up on this. I use the term in the book convergent evolution. I mean, neither Leontiev nor Nietzsche knew the other, and they developed their ideas completely independently of one another. I think they were both reacting to the way in which the 19th century was progressing, particularly the rise to dominance of a kind of utilitarian morality which they saw as leveling downwards. And they reacted against this. I mean, in his book, A Place of One's Own, Leontiev talks about the highly developed man as opposed to the undeveloped man. And it's very similar to what Nietzsche was saying about the Übermensch, the super sort of superman, as he's called. I think this pudding's been a bit over-egged over the years, to be frank. But it is such a striking similarity that really nobody writing about Leontiev can overlook it. Of course, this view really didn't survive the religious crisis. And in fact, Leontiev repented of this view later in his life. But it is a striking thing.
Yeah, you kind of briefly also mentioned Kierkegaard. So it's almost like he went from being like a Nietzsche figure to becoming like Soren Kierkegaard, the Danish existentialist.
There's not really much of Kierkegaard there, actually. It's a similarity of language. In later life, Leontiev very much took the view that religion should be based on fear, the fear of God. Or you could easily translate it as dread as well, which of course makes one think of Kierkegaard's notion of dread as the natural relationship of man to the overwhelming power of God. But apart from that similarity in language, I don't think there's an awful lot of proximity to Kierkegaard.
Now, soon after, a few years after his conversion experience, he then retires from the diplomatic service, and then Leontiev begins a series of political polemics with the Pan-Slavists, who want a united, they're kind of a continuation of the Slavophiles, but they want like a whole unified Slavic state under Russian rule. And Leontiev is kind of building on his experiences in the Ottoman Empire, and including the issue of the Bulgarian Orthodox Church, to kind of counteract some of their arguments. And perhaps you can explain this in further detail.
Yes, I mean, during the period in which Leontiev was spending his 11 years in the Ottoman Empire, the cultural Pan-Slavism of the older Slavophiles like Homiakov had transmuted slightly, well, a lot, into a political Pan-Slavism, which, as you rightly say, aimed at uniting the Slavs under Russian hegemony. Leontiev's primary concern, was with Russian culture. And he felt, rightly, that he'd had much better opportunity to observe the peoples of European Turkey at first hand than the people he described as armchair theorists in St. Petersburg, or more likely in Moscow, actually. He felt the Pan-Slavists were making a grave mistake in getting too close to the Western Slavs, the Bulgarians in particular, who Leontiev had observed, at least as far as their intelligentsia went, to be very, very imbued with the ideas of Western liberalism and democracy. And he feared that this could be transferred into Russia. And it was something he didn't want to see and believed that the Pan-Slavists didn't want to see. And he thought he didn't think that he was going against the Pan-Slavists, but he thought he had a duty to warn them of the danger that he felt they were running. wasn't a very easy thing for him. It got him into a lot of difficulties with the Pan-Slavists.
Yeah, and another issue that got him into fierce debate with the Pan-Slavists was kind of like critiquing the idea of racial-based nationalism, which was kind of becoming very prominent in this time period in the later half of the 19th century. We're most familiar with like the German version of this, but even the Russians and the Pan-Slavists had their own version of this, whereas Leontief was not arguing about race, but what he called ideas being at the heart of it, like the Orthodox Christian faith for Russia. And personally, when reading this, I was almost reminded of Lev Gumilev's concept of passionarity, you know, almost a century later when he's studying the nomads of Central Asia, in his concept of passionarity being at the heart of an ethnos. And I was just wondering if you could expand on Leontief's views of racial nationalism, and then also could you comment on whether or not that was an influence on Gumilev? Because you do mention him once in the introduction, I believe, as like part of his legacy, Leontief's legacy, that is. So,
yes. Well, Leontief spent 11 years in European Turkey. He was in Greece, in Bulgaria. These are in modern day terms: Greece, Bulgaria, Albania. What he observed, of course, was that there was no racial homogeneity there anyway, because the Greeks, the Bulgars, the Albanians, and the Turks are actually ethnically very different. And what he said was that just commonality of blood, which really the Russians only had with the Bulgars out of those four that I mentioned. He thought it was a very weak link, and he put forward the notion that actually what would draw people much closer together would be their common faith, their common Eastern Orthodox faith, which at least the Greeks and the Bulgars shared with the Russians, although the Albanians were mostly Islamic and the Turks too. So yes, he was very definite that a culture, particularly if it's going to be a multinational culture, has to have a central unifying idea, and he saw that in the common Eastern Orthodox faith. As to Gumilev, well, Gumilev himself said that Leontief was his preferred thinker of all Russian thinkers. And certainly Leontief held that what he called the Turanian element, which is the Asiatic element in the Russian makeup, was very fruitful culturally. And it was natural, I think, for someone like Gumilev, who is very much a representative of the Neo-Turanian view of Russian culture, that he should look to Leontief as a forerunner.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like: no fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
So yeah, and also in these polemics, particularly in, I believe, Byzantinism and Slavdom, which is one of his major works, he developed a triune process of civilizations. And could you possibly describe that in detail? And also, you kind of make a comment about the influence of another Russian thinker, Pyotr Sorokin, who later wrote a multi-volume study of cultural and social dynamics, which was kind of based on a tripartite dynamic between ideological, idealistic, and sensate cultures.
Right, yes.
So, yeah, could you elaborate on that?
Yes, thanks for reminding me of Sorokin's denominations. Yes, that's quite right. Yes, Leontiev looked at the history of cultures and states, and he took the view that they all follow a similar pattern of development from an original simplicity, which develops over time under the right conditions, into what he called a flowering complexity. This is very organic, this metaphor he develops. And but after a time, as a flower, it withers, and the culture is no longer able to sustain itself, and dies basically, and is replaced by another culture, which is on the process of developing. Danilevsky too, as no doubt you know, had a very similar view of this development, and it was a common thing in an age dominated by Darwinian thinking that societies could be seen to develop in these naturalistic terms. Sorokin is a very interesting person because he made the most, as you're probably aware, the most heroic effort to demonstrate this process in extraordinary collection of examination of cultural icons, which I frankly I scratched the surface of and didn't get much further than that because it is so huge. And but very interesting that he of course was a Russian, Peter M. Sorokin. He was actually Kerensky's secretary during the provisional government after the February Revolution, before he fled to the West. He certainly knew of Leontiev, but it's as far as I could see, it's not possible to establish that there was a particular connection there, though it is interesting that he does, as you say, use this tripartite division in much the same way Leontiev did. I think it's... I think we'll just have to leave it, though, as an interesting example of convergent thinking.
Yeah, and just as we talked about Nietzsche, in many ways, this naturalistic metaphor for the processes of civilization, that even prefigures the German meta-historian Oswald Spengler by several decades, too, when he wrote what's commonly translated as Decline of the West in the wake of World War I.
Yes, that's right. It was, I think it was something that was very much in the air. As I say, it's the idea that you could submit the development of cultures to a naturalistic, a scientific explanation was very much in accord with the 19th century attitude towards science and nature. And I think, yes, Leontiev is an interesting forerunner of all these people, really, because he predates them all, actually. And although, of course, having said that, you can go back further, that people like Auguste Comte in France, even Hegel, who fed into Leontiev. So it's a continuous process, really. But yes, you're quite right. The likes of Spengler and Sorokin came after him. And in many ways, whether consciously or unconsciously, built on the kind of work that he was doing.
Now, we did talk about Leontiev's conversion experience and how he converted to a very, you know, severe form of orthodoxy. But you do spend some time in the book explaining kind of like how his religious views did kind of evolve, including even towards the Catholic Church, kind of, because at first he kind of adopted kind of almost like the typical Orthodox hostility, but then he even becomes even more ecumenical towards the Catholic Church, while still remaining Orthodox, of course.
Yes, it's an interesting thing to speculate on where Leontiev would have ended up if he'd lived a little longer. He died at 60. He wasn't that old, although he was chronically ill for much of the last part of his life. He was definitely heading in the direction of Rome. That's pretty clear. Partly it was under the influence of Vladimir Sorogyov and his ecumenicalism. But also, I think it was a factor of disillusion in Leontiev's mind with the state-run Russian Church. He felt it was too subordinate to the Russian state, the procurator of the Holy Synod being in charge of it, a lay civil servant, Pavlina Nostev. He saw the Pope and the Roman faith, actually, I think, as a better bulwark against the kind of liberal ideas that he feared would disrupt Russian culture. So I think he was definitely heading in that direction. And the interesting thing about his faith, of course, is although he was and professed a severe form of Orthodox asceticism, in fact, there were many other features in his faith, a strong Islamic element in particular. Also, there was a dualistic element of the kind you see in the dualism of Zoroaster and Manichaeism. And there was even a Buddhist element, particularly after he discovered Schopenhauer. So he was a very complex man, and he had very complex notions. And it is very difficult to say with certainty that he was this or that or the other. My own feeling is that he would have converted to Rome, actually, had he lived. But that's only a guess on that part.
Now, we mentioned Danilevsky just a little bit ago, and he developed his own theory of civilizations, and there was kind of even this debate about whether or not Leontiev plagiarized him, but he kind of engaged in his own little debate with Danilevsky. So can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, Leontiev admired Danilevsky very much all his life. I don't know how he felt when he first read Russia and Europe in 1869, because essentially Danilevsky beat him to the punch. They were working along very, very similar lines. It must have been quite a shock to Leontiev to find that Danilevsky's book had come out. Did he plagiarize? It's a difficult question. He certainly used Danilevsky's book as a framework for his own. I have no doubt about that. Was it plagiarism? I'm not sure. But the great thing about Leontiev, though, is how he differed from Danilevsky. This is what really makes his work significant. And it is this very question of whether racial Slavism should be the way forward for Russia, or a cultural pan-orthodoxy with a strong Asiatic element, which Leontiev felt would be much more fruitful culturally going forward. He thought that a racial pan-Slavism would end up in a sterile, it would have a sterile outcome and be very subject to being taken over, actually, by Western influences. So although he disagreed with Danilevsky on this fundamental point, nonetheless, he did all his life maintained that Danilevsky was the great forerunner of his own ideas. He always felt to the end that he was developing Danilevsky's ideas in the teeth of criticism from many in the Pantsov camp who felt that he was betraying them. He felt completely the contrary, that he was developing them in the way that to the end of his life he believed the Slavists in Russia should have appreciated.
Now, in addition to his work on civilizations and political polemics, he also engaged in a lot of literary criticism. And this even led him to criticize possibly the two greatest Russian writers of the late 19th century, Leo Tolstoy and Fyodor Dostoevsky. And it's kind of interesting about Dostoevsky because you figure they were kind of more or less on the same camp, because Dostoevsky later on in life kind of turned towards a more conservative bent, just like Leontief. But could you first explain what was his criticisms of Tolstoy, and then we could get on to Dostoevsky?
Yes, well, Leontief was never afraid to have a go at some of the greatest icons of the age. We saw it with Turgenev earlier. In fact, the only one of the great four that he didn't really fall out with was Gogol. Tolstoy, he really didn't like Tolstoy at all, actually. He felt that he was calling into question most of the fundamental building blocks of Russian culture, which he, Leontief, was keen to defend. In particular, he didn't like his attitude to faith. And it's not so much a question of taking Tolstoy and Dostoevsky successively. The objection on Leontief's part was the same, actually, that they were... They both of them, in his view, missed the essential thing about faith, which was a mystical dread of the creator. He thought that this dread would, in the end, bring forth a love of the creator, and without it, that would not happen, and that faith would become something akin to social work in Dostoevsky's case, or indeed Marxism in Tolstoy's. And when you read some of the things that people like Lenin said about Tolstoy, it possibly wasn't too far off the mark there. But certainly the doctrine of love that Dostoevsky brings out, particularly obviously in the Brothers Karamazov and the legend of the Grand Inquisitor, and Tolstoy brings out in some of his shorter stories, in particular the parable I mentioned in the book of the fallen angel, who is sent to earth by God because he refuses to let a woman die as God has said he should. And God tells him to go down there and find out what men live by. And the angel comes back and says, well, they live by love, which is what he was sent down for in the first place, if you see Leontief's point of view. Anyway, I think his mystical, ascetic view of faith came into an absolute collision with this more, well, what he called rose-tinted view put forward by Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. I think that's a debate that could go on forever, actually. In the end, I guess you pay your money and you take your choice which one you want. But they're not entirely compatible entities, that's obvious.
Yeah, it sounded like that Leontief was kind of criticizing them for being overly sentimental in a way.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah. Sentimentalism, yes, I suppose that's true, yes. If, the idea of universal brotherly love, as postulated by Dostoevsky, he just didn't believe in it. he just didn't believe it was a reliable basis for faith or for human interaction. It didn't have the elements of mystical dread at its basis, which Leontiev, I think, basing himself very largely on his own experiences of a very passionate nature that had to be curbed by something, and he found this mystical faith to be that thing.
Yeah, and that kind of leads us into our next question, because we talked about Zelenev, and Zelenev, even in his philosophy, even though he's kind of considered like one of the greatest Russian philosophers of the 19th century and even of all time, but even in his discussions of nationalism, he kind of resorts to this kind of sentimental brotherhood of man. And Leontov kind of had a love-hate relationship with him, where he both greatly admired the work of Zelenev, but he also was very critical of it. And could you elaborate on that?
Yes, he admired Solovyov very much, both as a thinker and indeed as a man. It's probably not going in too far to say that he was actually in love with Solovyov for a long time. Yes, it was in the end, curiously, Solovyov's ecumenicalism and his leaning towards Rome is what actually made Leontiev fall out with him. Though, as I said earlier, curiously, it wasn't long after that Leontiev himself had a rethink, and he himself had a tendency to look to Rome as the possible future. I think that possibly the greatest influence, though, that Solovyov had on Leontiev was he put into his head this idea that a new Constantine the Great might arise at some point, put himself at the head of the Russian state and the Orthodox Church, and create a new cultural future for Russia in much the same way that Constantine the Great had put himself at the head of the Catholic Church and set in train a process which eventually came to fruition, although 1,000 years later, in the European Renaissance. And Leontiev, at the very end of his life, under the influence of Solovyov, believed this might be the way in which a new Russian Renaissance could be achieved. So I think Solovyov had a great influence on Leontiev, even though, as had been the case with others, in the short term at least, there was a considerable falling out. Although actually, many of Leontiev's more negative statements about Solovyov only came really in the last weeks before his death. So it is possible that his mind was by that time affected by his last illness.
Yeah, and you mentioned his death, and he died in 1891, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so what was his more immediate legacy or impact in Russia after his death, particularly as we get closer to the Russian Revolution? You even raised the possibility he may have been an influence on Stalin.
Yes, his immediate impact was very small, actually, after he died. The only two people who themselves made an impact on Russian letters, that's Vasily Rozanov and Lev Tikhomirov. They were the only two people who really took up his cudgel, as it were. There were a number of lesser known people, disciples of his, who kept his memory alive. But really, from then on until the revolution and past the revolution, he gradually became a discredited and forgotten figure for a long time under the Soviet regime. The interesting thing about Stalin is that I think it was in 1886, Pobedonostsev, the procurator of the Holy Synod, bought 60 copies of a compendium of Leontiev's articles for use in seminaries. Now, it's almost certain that one of these books went to the seminary in Tiflis, Tbilisi, where Stalin attended as a student for 5 years. It's just interesting to speculate as to whether Stalin may have come into contact with Leontiev's ideas. In my book, I build on work done by a Dutch professor, Erik van Rie, who looked at Stalin's early work before he became what he later became while he was still a revolutionist, and saw in them a strain of organic thinking, which you were talking about earlier, which van Rie felt was in the tradition of Danilevsky and Leontiev. Van Rie gives the primacy here to Danilevsky, but I do wonder, and one can only speculate, whether if in fact Stalin was influenced by this organic view of the world by either Danilevsky or Leontiev, it might quite possibly have been Leontiev, because of this decision by the Pobiedonostev to distribute his work to seminaries. It's an interesting idea. It's speculative. It will probably never be determined one way or the other. Now, I think Stalin would have made pretty sure that there was no link there between him and a chap who was one of the, under the Soviet view of the world, one of the darkest reactionaries of the late 19th century. So it's a thought, but it's no more than that.
Now, what relevance does Leontiev have for contemporary Russia and maybe even the wider world today, in your opinion?
Well, I think his relevance is huge, actually. Because you said earlier something about Leontiev being worth 100 professors or something. I think a close reading of Leontiev gives you as good an insight into the Russian way of thinking as anything, actually, and better than a lot. When we look at Putin's Russia today, you can see the tension between Russia as a Western European state and Russia as a world of its own to the east of Europe. This old debate between the Westernizers and the Slavophiles is still going on. And Leontiev, of course, is right in the center of that. So I think so many people look at Putin and they think, well, what is going on in this man's head? And Leontiev is a good way into it. I think there's another issue as well for us, actually, that it struck me for a while that there are striking similarities between the intellectual atmosphere in late 19th century Russia and indeed in the atmosphere in the West today, particularly the emergence of a rather intolerant strain of liberalism, intolerant of dissent, a feeling that if existing structures can be swept away, then newer and better ones will somehow rise of their own. This was very strong in Russia in the 19th century. And I think it's strong enough in the West today. And I think Leontiev acts as a kind of sanity check on these ideas. He says to us, well, maybe, but maybe not. Think about it. And I think if he can get people today to think about these things, then he will have done us all a good service.
Do you have any other concluding thoughts that you wish to make at this moment?
Well, not particularly. I think that was very useful, Stephen. Thanks very much. It's my first Zoom. So,
yeah, and I think I've taken up enough of your time. So what are you working on now?
Well, I mentioned earlier that there were two people who'd taken forward Leontief's ideas. One was Vasily Rozanov. I've been more interested in the other one, actually, Lev Tikhomirov. He's an interesting character. He was a revolutionist in his day. He was part of the People's Will group that assassinated the Tsar Alexander II in 1881. But later, he fled abroad following the assassination. He later petitioned the new Tsar to let him return to Russia, which they did. And he became a staunch monarchist and defender of orthodoxy. So he's quite an interesting character. So I've been taking a look at him, and we'll see what comes of that.
Well, this has been a very fascinating interview. Thank you for coming on to the New Books Network.
Okay, Stephen, thanks very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New Books Network. I am your host, Stephen Sakevich, of the Russia and Eurasian Studies channel. Until next time.